neither the thesis of capitalism nor the antithesis of communism, but a socially conscious democracy which reconciles the truths of individualism and collectivism. We have seen some moves in this direction. The Soviet Union has gradually moved away from its rigid communism and begun to concern itself with consumer products, art, and a general increase in benefits to the individual citizen. At the same time, through constant social reforms, we have seen many modifications in laissez-faire capitalism. The problems we now face must take us beyond slogans for their solution. In the final analysis, the right-wing slogans on government control and creeping socialism are as meaningless and adolescent as the Chinese Red Guard slogans against bourgeois revisionism. An intelligent approach to the problems of poverty and racism will cause us to see that the words of the psalmist, "The earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof," are still a judgment upon our use and abuse of the wealth and resources with which we have been endowed. A true revolution of values will soon cause us to question the fairness and justice of many of our past and present policies. We are called to play the Good Samaritan on life's roadside, but that will be only an initial act. One day, the whole Jericho Road must be transformed so that men and women will not be beaten and robbed as they make their journey through life. True compassion is more than flinging a coin to a beggar. It understands that an edifice which produces beggars needs restructuring. A true revolution of values will soon look uneasily on the glaring contrast of poverty and wealth. With righteous indignation, it will look at thousands of working people displaced from their jobs with reduced incomes as a result of automation, while the profits of the employers remain intact, and say, "This is not just." It will look across the oceans and see individual capitalists of the West investing huge sums of money in Asia, Africa, and South America, only to take the profits out with no concern for the social betterment of the countries, and say, "This is not just." It will look at our alliance with the landed gentry of Latin America and say, "This is not just." The Western arrogance of feeling that it has everything to teach others and nothing to learn from them is not just. A true revolution of values will lay hands on the world order and say of war, "This way of settling differences is not just." This business of burning human beings with napalm, of filling our nation's homes with orphans and widows, of injecting poisonous drugs of hate into the veins of peoples normally humane, of sending men home from dark and bloody battlefields, physically handicapped and psychologically deranged, cannot be reconciled with wisdom, justice, and love. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. America, the richest and most powerful nation in the world, can well lead the way in this revolution of values. There is nothing to prevent us from paying adequate wages to school teachers, social workers, and other servants of the public to ensure that we have the best available personnel in these positions, which are charged with the responsibility of guiding our future generations. There is nothing but a lack of social vision to prevent us from paying an adequate wage to every American citizen, whether he be a hospital worker, laundry worker, maid, or day laborer. There is nothing except short-sightedness to prevent us from guaranteeing an annual minimum and livable income for every American family. There is nothing except a tragic death wish to prevent us from reordering our priorities so that the pursuit of peace will take precedence over the pursuit of war. There is nothing to keep us from remolding a recalcitrant status quo with bruised hands until we have fashioned it into a brotherhood. This kind of positive revolution of values is our best defense against communism. War is not the answer. Communism will never be defeated by the use of atomic bombs or nuclear weapons. Let us not join those who shout war and who, through their misguided passions, urge the United States to relinquish its participation in the United Nations. These are days which demand wise restraint and calm reasonableness. We must not call everyone a communist or an appeaser who advocates the ceding of Red China in the United Nations, or who recognizes that hate and hysteria are not the final answers to the problems of these turbulent days. We must not engage in a negative anti-communism, but rather in a positive thrust for democracy, realizing that our greatest defense against communism is to take offensive action on behalf of justice. We must, with affirmative action, seek to remove those conditions of poverty, insecurity, and injustice, which are the fertile soil in which the seed of communism grows and develops. These are revolutionary times. All over the globe, men are revolting against old systems of exploitation and oppression. And out of the wombs of a frail world, new systems of justice and equality are being born. The shirtless and barefoot people of the earth are rising up as never before. The people who sat in darkness have seen a great light. We in the West must support these revolutions. It is a sad fact that because of comfort, complacency, a morbid fear of communism, and our proneness to adjust to injustice, the Western nations that initiated so much of the revolutionary spirit of the modern world have now become the arch anti-revolutionaries. This has driven many to feel that only Marxism has the revolutionary spirit. Communism is a judgment on our failure to make democracy real and to follow through on the revolutions that we initiated. Our only hope today lies in our ability to recapture the revolutionary spirit and go out into a sometimes hostile world, declaring eternal opposition to poverty, racism, and militarism. With this powerful commitment, we shall boldly challenge the status quo and unjust mores, and thereby speed the day when every valley shall be exalted, and every mountain and hill shall be made low, and the crooked shall be made straight, and the rough places plain. A genuine revolution of values means, in the final analysis, that our loyalties must become ecumenical rather than sectional. Every nation must now develop an overriding loyalty to mankind as a whole in order to preserve the best in their individual societies. This call for a worldwide fellowship that lifts neighborly concern beyond one's tribe, race, class, and nation is in reality a call for an all-embracing and unconditional love for all men. This often misunderstood and misinterpreted concept has now become an absolute necessity for the survival of man. When I speak of love, I am speaking of that force which all the great religions have seen as the supreme unifying principle of life. Love is the key that unlocks the door which leads to ultimate reality. This Hindu, Muslim, Christian, Jewish, Buddhist belief about ultimate reality is beautifully summed up in the first epistle of St. John. Let us love one another, for love is of God, and everyone that loveth is born of God and knoweth God. He that loveth not knoweth not God, for God is love. If we love one another, God dwelleth in us, and his love is perfected in us. Let us hope that this spirit will become the order of the day. We can no longer afford to worship the god of hate or bow before the altar of retaliation. The oceans of history are made turbulent by the ever-rising tides of hate. History is cluttered with the wreckage of nations and individuals who pursued this self-defeating path of hate. As Arnold Toynbee once said in a speech, "Love is the ultimate force that makes for the saving choice of life and good against the damning choice of death and evil." Therefore, the first hope in our inventory must be the hope that love is going to have the last word. We are now faced with the fact that tomorrow is today. We are confronted with the fierce urgency of now. In this unfolding conundrum of life and history, there is such a thing as being too late. Procrastination is still the thief of time. Life often leaves us standing bare, naked, and dejected with a lost opportunity. The tide in the affairs of men does not remain at the flood. It ebbs. We may cry out desperately for time to pause in her passage, but time is deaf to every plea and rushes on. Over the bleached bones and jumbled residues of numerous civilizations are written the pathetic words, "Too late." There is an invisible book of life that faithfully records our vigilance or our neglect. The moving finger writes, and having writ, moves on. We still have a choice today. Nonviolent coexistence or violent co-annihilation. This may well be mankind's last chance to choose between chaos and community. From Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community? Harper and Row, 1967. Reprinted by Beacon Press, 2010.
7. All the Great Religions of the World. Dr. King prepared this extensive statement for Red Book magazine on how Christianity, Judaism, Islam, Buddhism, and Hinduism might be effective in promoting peace and goodwill. It was published on November 5th, 1964.
What evidence is there that religion has ever been, or in the future could be, effective in promoting peace and goodwill among men? Or do you feel that peace depends primarily on new social and political institutions? Religion at its best has always sought to promote peace and goodwill among men. This is true of all the great religions of the world. In their ethical systems, we find the love ethic standing at the center. This is true of Judaism. This is true of Christianity. This is true of Islam, of Hinduism, and Buddhism. And if we go right through all the great religions of the world, we find the central message of love and this idea of the need for peace, the need for understanding, and the need for goodwill among men. Now the problem has been that these noble creeds and ethical insights of the great religions have not been followed by the adherents of the particular religions, and we must face the shameful fact that all too many religious people have been religious in their creeds but not enough in their deeds. I have felt all along that if religion, and this includes all religions, would take a real stand against war and go all out for peace and brotherhood, then we would be further along the way in making these into reality. I think the two are tied together. I don't think there can be peace without brotherhood, and I don't think you can have brotherhood without peace. To put it another way, I don't think there can be justice without peace, and I don't think there can be peace without justice. If religious institutions had really been true to their creeds all along, to the demand for justice, the demand for peace, then we would have peace and justice. Now, even though there have been a great deal of negligence, and even though the religions of the world have not done enough to inspire their followers to work passionately and unrelentingly for peace, I think that in the present and the future, religion can play a great role. If brotherhood is to become a reality, religion must somehow get into the thick of the battle for peace and reaffirm the fact that, as the Old Testament says, men must beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks, and nations must not rise up against nations, neither must they study war any more. If we are to have a just and lasting peace, religion will have to do more to influence the minds of men and women and to be true to their ethical insights. Now, I don't say that the political institutions don't have a great role to play, and I'm not unmindful of the fact that there are millions of people under political systems that would deny any claim to religion as we know it, because they are basically atheistic systems. Still, I don't want to go so far as to say that in these systems, there can't be a longing for peace. I firmly believe that religion, or even God, is that which concerns man ultimately. When we deal with the ultimate concerns, we are dealing with individuals who, whether they know it or not, have some form of religion. So I think that even in those situations, there can be a longing for peace. But I am sure that if the religions of the world are to bring about the peace that I am talking about and create the climate for it, they've got to rise to the level of not fighting among themselves. Some of the most tragic wars in the world have been religious wars. There's a need for individual religions to realize that God has revealed himself to all religions and there is some truth in all. And no religion can permit itself to be so arrogant that it fails to see that God has not left himself without a witness, even though it may be in another religion. Statement prepared for Red Book Magazine, November 5th, 1964.
8. My Jewish brother. Dr. King wrote this article on the evils of anti-Semitism for New York Amsterdam News, the black-owned newspaper, on February 26, 1966.
Recently, I was saddened, as I'm sure many other Americans were, to read that one of the leaders of a fine and militant civil rights group had made an anti-Semitic remark. In the heat of a controversy over school desegregation, this individual, who was a Negro, shouted to his audience, which included a number of Jewish people, a statement to the effect that Hitler had not killed enough Jews. Actually, I do not view this horrible outburst as anti-Jewish. I see it as anti-man and anti-God. It would be a statement to harshly condemn coming from anyone. It is singularly despicable coming from the lips of a black man. For black people, who have been torturously burned in the crucible of hatred for centuries, should have become so purified of hate in those scorching flames as to be instinctively intolerant of intolerance. In the struggle for human rights, as well as in the struggle for the upward march of our civilization, we have deep need for the partnership, fellowship, and courage of our Jewish brother. History will attest that the Hebrew prophets belong to all people, for it has been their concepts of justice and equality which have become ideals for all races and civilizations. Today, we particularly need the Hebrew prophets because they taught that to love God was to love justice, that each human being has an inescapable obligation to denounce evil where he sees it and to defy a ruler who commands him to break the covenant. The Hebrew prophets are needed today because decent people must be imbued with the courage to speak the truth, to realize that silence may temporarily preserve status or security, but that to live with a lie is a gross affront to God. It is scarcely a secret that many congressmen, educators, clergymen, and leaders of national affairs are gravely disturbed by our foreign policy. A war in which children are incinerated by napalm, in which American soldiers die in mounting numbers while other American soldiers, according to press accounts, in unrestrained hatred, shoot the wounded enemy as he lies upon the ground, is a war that mutilates the conscience. Yet, important leaders keep their silence. I know this to be true, because so many have confided in me that they shared my opinions, but not my willingness to state them in public. The Hebrew prophets are needed today because we need their flaming courage. We need them because the thunder of their fearless voices is the only sound stronger than the blasts of bombs and the clamor of war hysteria. The Hebrew prophets are needed today because Amos said, in words that echo across the centuries, "Let justice roll down like the waters and righteousness as a mighty stream." We need them because Micah said, in words lifted to cosmic proportions, "They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation. Neither shall they learn war any more." We need them because Isaiah said, "Yes, when ye make many prayers, I will not hear. Your hands are full of blood. Wash you, make you clean. Put away the evil of your doings from before mine eyes. Cease to do evil. I think the Hebrew prophets are among us today because although there are many pulpits that are empty while ministers physically occupy them, there are others from which the passion for justice and compassion for man is still heard. In the days to come, as the voices of sanity multiply, we will know that, across thousands of years of time, the prophet's message of truth and decency, brotherhood and peace survives, that they are living in our time to give hope to a tortured world, that their promise of the kingdom of God has not been lost to mankind. Originally published in New York Amsterdam News, New York, New York, February 26, 1966.
9. The Middle East question. This statement was made by Dr. King in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, SCLC, in Chicago in September 1967.
Serious distortions by the press have created an impression that the SCLC was part of a group at the Chicago Conference of New Politics which introduced a resolution condemning Israel and unqualifiedly endorsing all the policies of the Arab powers. The facts are as follows. Number one, the staff members of SCLC, who attended the conference not as official delegates, were the most vigorous and articulate opponents of the simplistic resolution on the Middle East question. As a result of this opposition, the Black Caucus modified its stand, and the convention voted to eliminate references to Zionism and referred to the executive board the matter of final wording. This change was the direct result of the spirited opposition on the floor by Hosea Williams, Southern Director of SCLC. Number two, SCLC and Dr. King have repeatedly stated that the Middle East problem embodies the related questions of security and development. Israel's right to exist as a state in security is incontestable. At the same time, the great powers have the obligation to recognize that the Arab world is in a state of imposed poverty and backwardness that must threaten peace and harmony. Until a concerted and democratic program of assistance is effected, tensions cannot be relieved. Neither Israel nor its neighbors can live in peace without an underlying basis of economic and social development. At the heart of the problem are oil interests. As the American Jewish Congress stated, American policies in the Middle East have been motivated in no small measure by the desire to protect the $2.5 billion stake which U.S. oil companies have invested in the area. Some Arab feudal rulers are no less concerned for oil wealth and neglect the plight of their own peoples. The solution will have to be found in statesmanship by Israel and progressive Arab forces who, in concert with the great powers, recognize that fair and peaceful solutions are the concern of all of humanity and must be found. Neither military measures nor a stubborn effort to reverse history can provide a permanent solution for peoples who need and deserve both development and security. Number three, SCLC and Dr. King have expressly, frequently, and vigorously denounced anti-Semitism and will continue to do so. It is not only that anti-Semitism is immoral, though that alone is enough. It is used to divide Negro and Jew, who have effectively collaborated in the struggle for justice. It injures Negroes because it upholds the doctrine of racism, which they have the greatest stake in destroying. The individual Jew or Gentile who may be an exploiter acts out of his greed as an individual, not his religious precepts. Just as a criminal, Negro or white, is expressing his antisocial tendencies, not the ethical values of his race. SCLC will continue tirelessly to denounce racism, whether its form is white supremacy or anti-Semitism. Statement by Dr. King in the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, Chicago, Illinois, September 1967.
10, let my people go. These remarks were made by Dr. King on Human Rights Day at a benefit speech for South Africa on December 10th, 1965 at Hunter College in New York. It was his second and most detailed speech on South Africa and called for an international alliance in opposition to apartheid.
Africa has been depicted for more than a century as the home of black cannibals and ignorant primitives. Despite volumes of facts contradicting this picture, the stereotype persists in books, motion pictures, and other media of communication. Africa does have spectacular savages and brutes today, but they are not black. They are the sophisticated white rulers of South Africa, who profess to be cultured, religious, and civilized, but whose conduct and philosophy stamp them unmistakably as modern-day barbarians. We are in an era in which the issue of human rights is the central question confronting all nations. In this complex struggle, an obvious but little appreciated fact has gained attention. The large majority of the human race is non-white, yet it is that large majority that lives in hideous poverty. While millions enjoy an unexampled opulence in developed nations, 10,000 people die of hunger each and every day of the year in the undeveloped world. To assert white supremacy, to invoke white economic and military power to maintain the status quo, is to foster the danger of international race war. Already the largest nation on earth, Red China plays seriously with the concept of color conflict. What does the South African government contribute to this tense situation? These are the incendiary words of the South African philosophy spoken by its Prime Minister, Dr. Vervoort. We want to keep South Africa white. Keeping it white can only mean one thing, namely white domination, not leadership, not guidance, but control, supremacy. The South African government, to make the white supreme, has had to reach into the past and revive the nightmarish ideology and practices of Nazism. We are witnessing a recrudescence of that barbarism which murdered more humans than any war in history. In South Africa today, all opposition to white supremacy is condemned as communism, and in its name, due process is destroyed. A medieval segregation is organized with 20th century efficiency and drive. A sophisticated form of slavery is imposed by a minority upon a majority who are kept in grinding poverty. The dignity of human personality is defiled, and world opinion is arrogantly defied. Once more we read of tortures in jails with electric devices, suicides among prisoners, forced confessions, while in the outside community ruthless persecution of editors, religious leaders, and political opponents suppresses free speech and a free press. South Africa says to the world, we have become a powerful industrial economy. We are too strong to be defeated by paper resolutions of world tribunals. We are immune to protest and to economic reprisals. We are invulnerable to opposition from within or without. If our evil offends you, you will have to learn to live with it. Increasingly in recent months, this conclusion has been echoed by sober commentators of other countries who disapprove, but nevertheless assert that there can be no remedy against this formidable adversary of human rights. Do we too acknowledge defeat? Have we tried everything and failed? In examining this question, as Americans, we are immediately struck by the fact that the United States moved with strikingly different energy when it reached a dubious conclusion that our interests were threatened in the Dominican Republic. We inundated that small nation with overwhelming force, shocking the world with our zealousness and naked power. With respect to South Africa, however, our protest is so muted and peripheral, it merely mildly disturbs the sensibilities of the segregationists. While our trade and investments substantially stimulate their economy to greater heights. We pat them on the wrist in permitting racially mixed receptions in our embassy and by exhibiting films depicting Negro artists. But we give them massive support through American investments in motor and rubber industries by extending some $40 million in loans through our most distinguished banking and financial institutions, by purchasing gold and other minerals mined by black slave labor, by giving them a sugar quota, by maintaining 3 tracking stations there, and by providing them with the prestige of a nuclear reactor built with our technical cooperation and fueled with refined uranium supplied by us. When it is realized that Great Britain, France, and other democratic powers also prop up the economy of South Africa, and when to all of this is added the fact that the USSR has indicated its willingness to participate in a boycott, it is proper to wonder how South Africa can so confidently defy the civilized world. The conclusion is inescapable that it is less sure of its own power, but more sure that the great nations will not sacrifice trade and profit to effectively oppose them. The shame of our nation is that it is objectively an ally of this monstrous government in its grim war with its own black people. Our default is all the more grievous because one of the blackest pages of our history was our participation in the infamous African slave trade of the 17th century. The rape of Africa was conducted substantially for our benefit to facilitate the growth of our nation and to enhance its commerce. There are few parallels in human history of the period in which Africans were seized and branded like animals, packed into ships' holds like cargo, and transported into chattel slavery. Millions suffered agonizing death in the Middle Passage in a holocaust reminiscent of the Nazi slaughter of Jews, Poles, and others. We have an obligation of atonement that is not canceled by the passage of time. Indeed, the slave trade in one sense was more understandable than our contemporary policy. There was less sense of humanity in the world 300 years ago. The slave trade was widely approved by the major powers of the world. The economies of England, Spain, and the United States rested heavily on the profits derived from it. Today in our opulent society, our reliance on trade with South Africa is infinitesimal in significance. No real national interest impels us to be cautious, gentle, or a good customer of a nation that offends the world's conscience. Have we the power to be more than peevish with South Africa, but yet refrain from acts of war? To list the extensive economic relations of the great powers with South Africa is to suggest a potent nonviolent path. The international potential of nonviolence has never been employed. Nonviolence has been practiced within national borders in India, the United States, and in regions of Africa with spectacular success. The time has come fully to utilize nonviolence through a massive international boycott, which would involve the USSR, Great Britain, France, the United States, Germany, and Japan. Millions of people can personally give expression to their abhorrence of the world's worst racism through such a far-flung boycott. No nation professing a concern for man's dignity could avoid assuming its obligations if people of all states and races adopted a firm stand. Nor need we confine an international boycott to South Africa. Rhodesia has earned a place as a target, as has Portugal, colonial master of Angola and Mozambique. The time has come for an international alliance of peoples of all nations, against racism. For the American Negro, there is a special relationship with Africa. It is the land of his origin. It was despoiled by invaders. Its culture was arrested and concealed to justify white supremacy. The American Negro's ancestors were not only driven into slavery, but their links with their past were severed so that their servitude might be psychological as well as physical. In this period when the American Negro is giving moral leadership and inspiration to his own nation, he must find the resources to aid his suffering brothers in his ancestral homeland. Nor is this aid a one-way street. The civil rights movement in the United States has derived immense inspiration from the successful struggles of those Africans who have attained freedom in their own nations. The fact that black men govern states, are building democratic institutions, sit in world tribunals, and participate in global decision-making gives every Negro a needed sense of dignity. In this effort, the American Negro will not be alone. As this meeting testifies, there are many white people who know that liberty is indivisible. Even more inspiring is the fact that in South Africa itself, incredibly brave white people are risking their careers, their homes, and their lives in the cause of human justice. Nor is this a plea to Negroes to fight on two fronts. The struggle for freedom forms one long front, crossing oceans and mountains. The Brotherhood of Man is not confined within a narrow, limited circle of select people. It is felt everywhere in the world. It is an international sentiment of surpassing strength, and because this is true, when men of goodwill finally unite, they will be invincible. Through recent anthropological discoveries, science has substantially established that the cradle of humanity is Africa. The earliest creatures who passed the divide between animal and man seem to have first emerged in East and South Africa. Professor Raymond Dart described this historical epoch as the moment when man trembled on the brink of humanity. A million years later, in the same place, some men of South Africa are again trembling on the brink of humanity. But instead of advancing from pre-human to human, they are reversing the process and are traveling backward in time from human to pre-human. Civilization has come a long way. It has far still to go, and it cannot afford to be set back by resolute wicked men. Negroes were dispersed over thousands of miles and over many continents, yet today they have found each other again. Negro and white have been separated for centuries by evil men and evil myths, but they have found each other. The powerful unity of Negro with Negro and white with Negro is stronger than the most potent and entrenched racism. The whole human race will benefit when it ends the abomination that has diminished the stature of man for too long. This is the task to which we are called by the suffering in South Africa, and our response should be swift and unstinting. Out of this struggle will come the glorious reality of the family of man. South Africa Benefit Speech, Hunter College, New York, New York, December 10th, 1965.
11. Honoring Dr. Du Bois. This essay by Dr. King was originally published by the editors of Freedom Ways in a collection of writings by and about W.E.B. Du Bois titled Black Titan. Freedom Ways, a quarterly review of the freedom movement, was a leading provocative journal edited by black Americans from the 1960s to the 1980s.
Tonight we assemble here to pay tribute to one of the most remarkable men of our time. Dr. Du Bois was not only an intellectual giant exploring the frontiers of knowledge, he was in the first place a teacher. He would have wanted his life to teach us something about our tasks of emancipation. One idea he insistently taught was that black people have been kept in oppression and deprivation by a poisonous fog of lies that depicted them as inferior, born deficient, and deservingly doomed to servitude to the grave. So assiduously has this poison been injected into the mind of America that its disease has infected not only whites, but many Negroes. So long as the lie was believed, the brutality and criminality of conduct toward the Negro was easy for the conscience to bear. The twisted logic ran, if the black man was inferior, he was not oppressed. His place in society was appropriate to his meager talent and intellect. Dr. Du Bois recognized that the keystone in the arc of oppression was the myth of inferiority, and he dedicated his brilliant talents to demolish it. There could scarcely be a more suitable person for such a monumental task. First of all, he was himself unsurpassed as an intellect, and he was a Negro. But beyond this, he was passionately proud to be black, and finally, he had not only genius and pride, but he had the indomitable fighting spirit of the valiant. To pursue his mission, Dr. Du Bois gave up the substantial privileges the highly educated Negro enjoyed living in the North. Though he held degrees from Harvard and the University of Berlin, though he had more academic credentials than most Americans, black or white, he moved south where a majority of Negroes then lived. He deliberately chose to share their daily abuse and humiliation. He could have offered himself to the white rulers and exact substantial tribute for selling his genius. There were few like him, Negro or white. He could have amassed riches and honors, and lived in material splendor and applause from the powerful and important men of his time. Instead, he lived part of his creative life in the South, most of it in modest means, and some of it in poverty, and he died in exile, praised sparingly, and in many circles ignored. But he was in exile only to the land of his birth. He died at home in Africa, among his cherished ancestors, and he was ignored by a pathetically ignorant America, but not by history. History cannot ignore W.E.B. Du Bois, because history has to reflect truth, and Dr. Du Bois was a tireless explorer and gifted discoverer of social truths. His singular greatness lay in his quest for truth about his own people. There were very few scholars who concerned themselves with honest study of the black man, and he sought to fill this immense void. The degree to which he succeeded discloses the great dimensions of the man. Yet he had more than a void to fill. He had to deal with the army of white propagandists, the mythmakers of Negro history. Dr. Du Bois took them all on in battle. It would be impossible to sketch the whole range of his intellectual contributions. Back in the 19th century, he laid out a program of 100 years of study of problems affecting American Negroes and worked tirelessly to implement it. Long before sociology was a science, he was pioneering in the field of social studies of Negro life and completed works on health, education, employment, urban conditions, and religion. This was at a time when scientific inquiry of Negro life was so unbelievably neglected that only a single university in the entire nation had such a program, and it was funded with $5,000 for a year's work. Against such odds, Dr. Du Bois produced two enduring classics before the 20th century. His Suppression of the African Slave Trade, written in 1896, is Volume 1 in the Harvard Historical Studies. His study, The Philadelphia Negro, completed in 1899, is still used today. Illustrating the painstaking quality of his scientific method, to do this work, Dr. Du Bois personally visited and interviewed 5,000 people. He soon realized his studies would never adequately be pursued, nor changes realized, without the mass involvement of Negroes. The scholar then became an organizer, and with others founded the NAACP. At the same time, he became aware that the expansion of imperialism was a threat to the emergence of Africa. He recognized the importance of the bonds between American Negroes and the land of their ancestors, and extended his activities to African affairs. After World War I, he called Pan-African Congresses in 1919, 1921, and 1923, alarming imperialists in all countries and disconcerting Negro moderates in America who were afraid of this restless, militant black genius. Returning to the United States from abroad, he found his pioneering agitation for Negro studies was bearing fruit, and a beginning was made to broaden Negro higher education. He threw himself into the task of raising the intellectual level of this work. Much later, in 1940, he participated in the establishment of the first Negro scholarly publication, Phylon. At the same time, he stimulated Negro colleges to collaborate through annual conferences to increase their effectiveness and elevate the quality of their academic studies. But these activities, enough to be the life work of 10 men, were far from the sum of his achievements. In the 6 years between 1935 and 1941, he produced the monumental 700-page volume on Black Reconstruction in America, and at the same time, writing many articles and essays. Black Reconstruction was 6 years in writing, but 33 years in preparation. On its publication, one critic said, "It crowns the long and selfish and brilliant career of Dr. Du Bois. It is comparable in clarity, originality, and importance to the Beard's Rise of American Civilization." The New York Times said, "It is beyond question the most painstaking and thorough study ever made of the Negro's part in Reconstruction." And the New York Herald Tribune proclaimed it a solid history of the period, an economic treatise, a philosophical discussion, a poem, a work of art, all rolled into one. To understand why his study of the Reconstruction was a monumental achievement, it is necessary to see it in context. White historians had for a century crudely distorted the Negro's role in the Reconstruction years. It was a conscious and deliberate manipulation of history, and the stakes were high. The Reconstruction was a period in which black men had a small measure of freedom of action. If, as white historians tell it, Negroes wallowed in corruption, opportunism, displayed spectacular stupidity, were wanton, evil, and ignorant, their case was made. They would have proved that freedom was dangerous in the hands of inferior beings. One generation after another of Americans were assiduously taught these falsehoods, and the collective mind of America became poisoned with racism and stunted with myths. Dr. Du Bois confronted this powerful structure of historical distortion and dismantled it. He virtually before anyone else, and more than anyone else, demolished the lies about Negroes in their most important and creative period of history. The truths he revealed are not yet the property of all Americans, but they have been recorded and arm us for our contemporary battles. In Black Reconstruction, Dr. Du Bois dealt with the almost universal accepted concept that civilization virtually collapsed in the South during Reconstruction because Negroes had a measure of political power. Dr. Du Bois marshaled irrefutable evidence that far from collapsing, the Southern economy was recovering in these years. Within 5 years, the cotton crop had been restored, and in the succeeding 5 years had exceeded pre-war levels. At the same time, other economic activity had ascended so rapidly, the rebirth of the South was almost completed. Beyond this, he restored to light the most luminous achievement of the Reconstruction. It brought free public education into existence, not only for the benefit of the Negro, but it opened school doors to the poor whites. He documented the substantial body of legislation that was socially so useful it was retained into the 20th century, even though the Negroes who helped to write it were brutally disenfranchised and driven from political life. He revealed that far from being the tragic era white historians described, it was the only period in which democracy existed in the South. This stunning fact was the reason the history books had to lie, because to tell the truth would have acknowledged the Negroes' capacity to govern and fitness to build a finer nation in a creative relationship with poor whites. With the completion of his book, Black Reconstruction, despite his towering contributions, despite his advanced age, Dr. Du Bois was still not ready to accept a deserved rest and peaceful retirement. His dedication to freedom drove him on as relentlessly in his 70s as it did in his 20s. He had already encompassed three careers. Beginning as a pioneer sociologist, he had become an activist to further mass organization. The activist had then transformed himself into a historian. By the middle of the 20th century, when imperialism and war rose once more to imperil humanity, he became a peace leader. He served as chairman of the Peace Information Bureau, and like the Reverend William Sloan Kaufman and Benjamin Spock of today, he found himself indicted by the government and harried by reactionaries. Undaunted by obstacles and repression, with his characteristic fortitude, he fought on. Finally, in 1961, with Ghana's independence established, an opportunity opened to begin the writing of an African encyclopedia. And in his 93rd year, he immigrated to Ghana to begin new intellectual labors. In 1963, death finally came to this most remarkable man. It's axiomatic that he will be remembered for his scholarly contributions and organizational attainments. These monuments are imperishable, but there are human qualities, less immediately visible, that are no less imperishable. Dr. Du Bois is a man possessed of priceless dedication to his people. The vast accumulation of achievement and public recognition were not for him pathways to personal affluence and the diffusion of identity. Whatever else he was, with his multitude of careers and professional titles, he was first and always a black man. He used his richness of talent as a trust for his people. He saw the Negroes were robbed of so many things decisive to their existence that the theft of their history seemed only a small part of their losses. But Dr. Du Bois knew that to lose one's history is to lose one's self-understanding and with it the roots for pride. This drove him to become historian of Negro life, and the combination of his unique zeal and intellect rescued for all of us a heritage whose loss would have profoundly impoverished us. Dr. Du Bois, the man, needs to be remembered today when despair is all too prevalent. In the years he lived and fought, there was far more justification for frustration and hopelessness, yet his faith in his people never wavered. His love and faith in Negroes permeate every sentence of his writings and every act of his life. Without these deeply rooted emotions, his work would have been arid and abstract. With them, his deeds were a passionate storm that swept the filth of falsehood from the pages of established history. He symbolized in his being his pride in the black man. He did not apologize for being black and because of it, handicapped. Instead, he attacked the oppressor for the crime of stunning black men. He confronted the establishment as a model of militant manhood and integrity. He defied them, and though they heaped venom and scorn on him, his powerful voice was never stilled. And yet with all this pride and spirit, he did not make a mystique out of blackness. He was proud of his people, not because their color endowed them with some vague greatness, but because their concrete achievements in struggle had advanced humanity. And he saw and loved progressive humanity in all its hues, black, white, yellow, red, and brown. Above all, he did not content himself with hurling invectives for emotional release and then retire into smug passive satisfaction. History had taught him it is not enough for people to be angry. The supreme task is to organize and unite people so that their anger becomes a transforming force. It was never possible to know where the scholar Du Bois ended and the organizer Du Bois began. The two qualities in him were a single unified force. This lifestyle of Dr. Du Bois is the most important quality this generation of Negroes needs to emulate. The educated Negro is not really a part of us, and the angry militant who fails to organize us have nothing in common with Dr. Du Bois. He exemplified black power in achievement, and he organized black power in action. It was no abstract slogan to him. We cannot talk about Dr. Du Bois without recognizing that he was a radical all of his life. Some people would like to ignore the fact that he was a communist in his later years. It is worth noting that Abraham Lincoln warmly welcomed the support of Karl Marx during the Civil War and corresponded with him freely. In contemporary life, the English-speaking world has no difficulty with the fact that Sean O'Casey was a literary giant of the 20th century and a communist, or that Pablo Neruda is generally considered the greatest living poet, though he also served in the Chilean Senate as a communist. It is time to cease muting the fact that Dr. Du Bois was a genius and chose to be a communist. Our irrational, obsessive anti-communism has led us into too many quagmires to be retained as if it were a mode of scientific thinking. In closing, it would be well to remind white America of its debt to Dr. Du Bois. When they corrupted Negro history, they distorted American history, because Negroes are too big a part of the building of this nation to be written out of it without destroying scientific history. White America, drenched with lies about Negroes, has lived too long in the fog of ignorance. Dr. Du Bois gave them a gift of truth for which they should eternally be indebted to him. Negroes have heavy tasks today. We were partially liberated and then re-enslaved. We have to fight again on old battlefields, but our confidence is greater, our vision is clearer, and our ultimate victory sure because of the contributions a militant, passionate black giant left behind him. Dr. Du Bois has left us, but he has not died. The spirit of freedom is not buried in the grave of the valiant. He will be with us when we go to Washington in April, to demand our right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. We have to go to Washington because they have declared an armistice in the war on poverty while squandering billions to expand a senseless, cruel, unjust war in Vietnam. We will go there. We will demand to be heard. We will stay until the administration responds. If this means forcible repression of our movement, we will confront it, for we have done this before. If this means scorn and ridicule, we will embrace it, for that is what America's poor now receive. If it means jail, we will accept it willingly, for the millions of poor already are imprisoned by exploitation and discrimination. Dr. Du Bois would be in the front ranks of the peace movement today. he would readily see the parallel between the American support of the corrupt and despised Chuqui regime and Northern support of the Southern slave masters in 1876.